Hello everyone, I am Mirta Hurtado Rivas. No VIPs or rock stars, just simple people sharing their life stories to trigger discussions around important topics, or simply to inspire us to embrace challenges ourselves. Welcome to Leaderching. Hello everyone, and welcome back to another episode of Leaderching. My guest today is Peter Müller, partner of Müller Schuffner and partner in Munich. Hi, Peter. How are you?
Hi, Mirta. I'm fine. Thank you. How are you?
I'm very good. Thanks for being my guest today.
Oh, sure.
So let's directly dive into the questions, Peter. My first question is, what did you dream of becoming as a child?
That's a funny question. Actually, when I was a child, I was constructing model planes, radio-controlled model planes. So in the first idea I had, I wanted to become a pilot, of course. But later on, I realized that this might not be the ideal profession, since my father and some friends told me that pilots are like bus drivers. And over the time, it might become boring. So my father recommended I should rather become something else and do the flying as a hobby. So then I actually decided to become a carpenter.
Okay, that's interesting. I didn't know that. But let's go back just for a second to the fact that you were constructing airplane models. Where did this fascination come from?
That was actually my parents' strategic idea, because one of my uncles, he constructed radio-controlled aircraft, and my parents asked him to come along and teach my brother and me in doing this. So that was actually when I was like 5 or 6 years old. My brother was 3 years older, so he was like 9. And so we started actually constructing aircraft with the help of my uncle. And later on, we got fascinated. And then actually, we would not use any longer these sets, which you can buy from factory, but we would actually buy the original construction plans from Piper or Cessna from the United States. And then we would go into our cellar and we would reconstruct these original aircraft, of course, in a smaller scale. For example, we constructed the Piper J3 Cup in the scale 1 to 4, and we used the engine of my father's lawnmower. So we dismantled the engine, put it in the aircraft, and then actually we didn't have any propeller, because the propeller you would get for model planes, they were too small. So then actually we continued and constructed a GFK form to build the propeller ourselves. And we did many things actually by just looking into how it works and thinking about our own solution. So that was great fun.
So it seems that you were both very much into, you know, technical aspects, into this manufacturing. So was your uncle kind of his profession related to this area, or was it also a hobby for him?
It was a hobby for him. Actually, he was quite bored in his job. So I thought this was, he was like, he was in the cellar the whole time, so he wouldn't care much about his family, which I think was not so nice about this hobby. But since we were young kids, we liked it a lot. So I spent most of my childhood actually either in a swimming pool, swimming, or in the cellar building model planes.
Excellent. So you mentioned just now that then you kind of had the thought of becoming a carpenter. How did that happen?
Well, that came out of myself, actually. I always liked working with wood and making cupboards and laying a floor and doing all kinds of stuff, because I liked two ideas. The first idea was working with wood, like a natural building material, and second, that after a day's work, you can see what you have done, which is quite different in my current profession, since I'm a patent attorney. So only recently I was leaving my office, and I was looking back into my office, and I was thinking, well, I have been working in this office for 25 years, but it still looks as 25 years ago, just paper and files. And so you have the impression that you have done nothing, so to say.
I understand. It's a tangible aspect of doing something with your hands and having then an outcome that it's palpable, right?
Exactly.
Yeah, I have something similar with sawing, which is, I think, also something is there and then you can wear it. Whereas when I do trademarks, you cannot really wear them.
I know your dresses. They are beautiful.
Thank you, Peter. You're very kind. So going back to, so you kind of had this aspiration for carpentering, and then you mentioned yourself now, you became finally a patent attorney. So how did you go from carpenter to patent attorney? What happened in between?
Well, the profession of carpenter was impossible because my father, of course, pushed me to do some studies. And of course, he said that as a carpenter, I won't earn a lot of money and it's an unsecure job and blah, blah, blah. So I was thinking of either studying law, architecture, or some technical studies. But again, the law studies, I realized you have to be among the top 10%, at least in Germany, to have a decent job afterwards where you earn enough money. The second idea, architecture, it's quite similar. Most architects work in very simple offices with doing like family houses or simple structures. So a good friend of mine, an older friend, he came along and he said he was an architect. And he said, well, if you are not among the top like 5%, you will do more or less the same thing each day. So finally, I ended up studying electrical engineering.
Okay, interesting. And so we all know now, well, you then became a patent attorney and finally are working as a patent attorney for a while now. Do you recall that, was there any specific learnings from your childhood, from your upbringing that you think kind of helped you, you know, going through your path until becoming a patent attorney? Is there anything that you recall that were things that kind of you acquired when you were younger that then you applied while you were becoming then a patent attorney?
Yeah, I think so. Maybe several aspects. Because after my studies as an electrical engineer, I first started to work as an assistant with Anderson Consulting, which is now called Accenture. So I was like working mm-hmm. as a business consultant, but quickly I disliked the way how I was working. So I had to travel, you know, between Berlin, Frankfurt, and Munich every second day, a different location. I met lots of weird people, some of them very, snobbish, I think, and I realized that I won't be able to set up a real family with such kind of work. And so since I was brought up in a very nice and kind family, I always wanted to have my own family. So that was one of the aspects from my childhood. And the second one, certainly the technical aspect, which I learned through the model construction. I realized that I want to become or to have a job which is a technical job. But of course, also the legal side, I was interested as well. And of course, the profession of my father gave me another hint, because my father is a patent attorney, or used to be a patent attorney, but he never pushed me into this profession, neither me nor my brother. So my brother, he disliked the profession as a patent attorney very much. He still dislikes it very much. He thinks we are crazy, struggling for years all the way up to the Supreme Court because of one word in a patent claim. So he thinks we are crazy. But my father never pushed us in any direction. So actually, I decided to become a patent attorney when I was in New York. I was working at the end of my studies as a young student in a larger U.S. Patent law firm, Hopgood Kalimafte Jutlow, and Mr. Hopgood, Roy Hopgood. He actually inspired me a lot, and he showed me each day in his corner office all kinds of different inventions, ideas, and structures. And here I realized that I can like combine the model constructing career, so I like working with technical devices, with the idea of having also some legal touch, which I was interested in anyway. So I thought this is the ideal combination.
Thanks so much for sharing that, Peter. It's really interesting to see how the things we do as children can have an impact on what we choose to do later on. You mentioned now that you have been in different roles during your career, and I'm sure that, and you just mentioned one of your kind of mentors or managers that inspired you while you were in New York. So you have come across probably a lot of different type of managers, leaders. And I wanted to know from you what you think a good leader is, what attributes or characteristics a good leader has.
That's a good question, because there are all, I think it very much depends on the profession in which you are working in. So a leader maybe in the fashion industry could be different to a leader in the legal industry. However, I think certain aspects are universal. For example, to seek for the best in your team members or employees, not to try to be the best yourself, but to dig into the capabilities and interests and ways how your team members work on issues, and try to make them prevail and to make them better in their job, maybe even better than yourself. So I think a good leader will form people all the way until they are even better as the leader himself or herself. I guess that's the best leader, because then you can also, the team effort will be better in the end than what you could have done yourself, let's say with unlimited time. So that's a kind of empathy for your team members. I guess that's very important. At the same time, I think you should have a very, I would say, integrity. Integrity, I guess, is very important, that you say what you do and you do what you say, so that all your team members can rely on you, so that there is no false impression, no lying, no bullying, etc. So that is, I guess, very important. And here, as it comes to myself, I think my Christian raising of my family was very important. I mean, I was very active in the Protestant church. I was leading youth groups. I even made an extra education as a lay priest. So when the priest was ill, actually, I did the service in church. So I would go and talk to the people, etc. And that, I guess, influenced me as well in treating my people with empathy and trying to make them happy in their own job.
Interesting. I think the statement that you made around integrity is something that we are hearing a lot lately. and not only about the sense of, you know, walking the talk or acting according to your words, but also the aspect of being authentic, right? Being your true self, so
definitely.
That people can, I think, understand you and will know you, and hence, even if they don't or like you independently, but they know who you are and how you act. And I think that goes together with this sense of integrity that you shared just now. You just mentioned now your faith and some of the things you did, you know, within the structure of the church. As all of us, I'm sure that during your career, during your professional development, you also had challenges and difficulties that you had to overcome. Can you maybe share with us how you normally try to overcome difficult situations? What is it? What type of kind of interior process do you follow? What thinking path do you follow to kind of master the situations?
Well, first principle, I think, is value relationship, social relationship higher than money. So whenever the question was to earn money or to safeguard a relationship, I would always go for the relationship. Of course, it depends on the amount of money, but... But let's say, okay, as long as it does not touch me seriously in my well-being and in my way how I live, you know, if I can continue the way I'm living, if I can afford my family, if I have my car, my holiday, etc., that's fine. You know, I'm not seeking to become super rich or to have a yacht or to have two summer houses in the Alps. That's not what I'm striving for. I'm striving more for human relationships and for friendships, etc. And maybe I can, there was one striking moment in my life. That was 2001, nearly 20 years ago, when my mother died. My mother never worked. I mean, she worked, but when she met my father, that was in the 60s, it was clear at these times that she had to stay at home and my father would go to work. And she stayed at home the whole time. Still, while she was at home, she was establishing a neighborhood help in our village, ending up with more than 100 people working for her after like 25 years. She set up several institutions, like for children after school. So there was a daycare, there was a care for old people, etc., etc. And she was really, she never earned a cent. But in the end, when she died and we buried her and we took her to the grave, more than 400 people were there. And I was shocked. Because I realized that when I will die, maybe 20 or 30 people will be there. So that was like the people I knew. And here I realized that my mother, not earning a cent, was one of the most popular people in the village. And she even got the Bundesverdienstkreuz of the president of Germany, the medal for pro bono work. After her death. So that was a very kind gesture of the Federal Republic of Germany to honor her work. And that impressed me a lot. And that still governs my decisions. When I think about doing A or B, I always go for the relationship and not for the money. So that is one of my core decision rules, I must say.
Thank you. Thank you for sharing this, because I think it's quite private. And I think on the other hand, it's also very telling to just refer to your mother. And I think we all have come across people like this who even without getting financial return on their work, on their investment, would do a great deal of good around them. And I think they are an inspiration for many of us, right? And especially in those days, I think a lot of women actually took on roles where they didn't actually get paid for, but still did a lot of good for society overall.
Yeah, especially in these times. I mean, now it's different because I think money is ruling the world more and more, which I think is of course, I mean, money is necessary. Companies must earn money. They must make a profit, of course. But often it becomes too extreme. And here, I think we as leaders could push to make a change, not only as it comes to a social relationship, but also, for example, environmental questions. You know, do I produce my product with the maximum profit, or do I produce my product with a profit plus maybe some environmental profit? And here I think companies and industry must change the way they approach things nowadays. I think that's very important.
Yeah, I think we had already once a discussion around this, both of us. We were discussed actually, is it upon the consumer to change his acquisition, ways, decisions, right? Is it on us as consumers to demand products which are produced in a more sustainable way, in a more environmental friendly way? Or is it to the companies by themselves to change this, or via the government, via obliging? But I think overall, we agreed that there is a need for accountability, right? The accountability part in the role each of us plays, not only as leaders, but each of us. And then obviously the companies themselves as to how they produce and how they earn a profit.
Yes, I fully agree. So you cannot say it's the consumer's task or it's the government's task or the company's task. I think it's the task of everyone in every position. You as a consumer, if you can afford it, I mean, many consumers, they cannot afford buying more expensive products just because they are biological or they are manufactured sustainably. But it's also in the politicians, should be in the politicians' mind and in the industry leaders' mind. So I think we all together should change the way we live on this earth and produce products and consume products. And I think it is changing already, but maybe only for 10% or even less of the world's population. The other 95% are still living in the old ways. I mean, I'm not saying that this is bad. It's just saying that they cannot afford right now what some of us might do.
Excellent. Thank you for that thought. And I think actually this is the first time during Leader Ching that we end up talking about this. But allow me to just go a little bit back. You made a reference to your mother, and I think you know that one of my favorite topics is gender equality. and obviously, I cannot let you go without asking you about this topic. I would like to hear from you if you believe that there is still a need to talk about the gender topic. Do you think that, for instance, in Germany, where you are, there is still a need for us to talk about it, to take things into our hands and make a change? Or do you believe that we have gotten to a position where we are quite okay?
I don't think so. If you look at the numbers, especially in Germany, if you look at the DAX 30 companies and the way how women are represented in the management teams, if you look at the startup companies, I mean, I as far as I remember, more than 80% of all startups in Germany are started by men. And only 2 weeks ago, yes, actually, or 3 weeks ago, I was in a lecture here in Munich by Verena Pauster. Maybe you know her, Verena Pauster. She is a very successful woman helping startups in starting their companies. She is also very active in changing the way we educate our pupils, especially girls. And I have two girls at school, and I can see that, especially in Germany or even more in Bavaria, schools are still working the way they have been working since the 80s. So, for example, my two children, my two daughters, they have different subjects than men. For example, in sports, my daughter, she always complains she's never able to play soccer. She's never able to play handball and all the male sports. She always has to do the female sports. So that's for example one example. Or even in the school, women or girls are still treated differently by the teachers than boys. And this goes deep into the heart and the soul of girls. So once they are grown up, maybe after university, we all know that women are have better grades after they leave university, and there are more women leaving universities than men. Still, they don't achieve the same positions. And here, I think, I don't know whether it's a psychological thing, but just one example. I'm a member of the school council, of the parents' school council in our school of my girls. And as such, I have now been elected to become a board member of the Bavarian parents' representation towards the Bavarian government. And during that time, during the last 2 years, I realized that the persons representing pupils are usually females. So females are very active in school matters. But as it comes to the question who's taking a lead position, for example, of a regional council, or as I just said, of the Bavarian management board, where I'm a member now, in four or five cases, men would raise their hands if a leading position has to be given to somebody. Women often refrain from raising their hand when they are asked to take a leadership position. I don't know why.
That's a very good example. Yeah, I like the example, and I also like the fact that you're giving us very kind of, you know, practical examples of what's happening, because I think for many, the gender discussion is immediately linked to equal pay, which is also important. But I think that that's kind of probably the ultimate result of the rest. So I think that you kind of put the finger on one of the burning issues, and that's that education, and in particular the education that our children are receiving at school, it's still in many cases still very old-fashioned, and actually is leading girls to continue to become the women that even my generation still is, which is that we need, in many cases, definitely more encouragement, and need to find more support to actually dare reaching out for things that we believe are out of our reach. And I think that still is limiting many of us. So I'm very thankful for you for giving this really clear examples, because sometimes we have the feeling that people refer to the gender issue as something that happens in countries that are less developed. But as you just pointed out, this is happening in Germany, which is a very advanced and developed country. So thank you so much for sharing that. We are getting to the end of our conversation, okay, Peter. Before I let you go, I would like to know if you were able to go back to when you were in your 20s, which advice would you give yourself?
In which direction are you asking? Professionally?
Whatever you can, whatever. People have answered this in many different ways, but if you kind of, you know, it's always interesting to hear what people with the experience of their current age would tell themselves if they could, obviously, right? Because it's all hypothetical. If you could go back and you could talk to yourself, what is it that you would give you as an advice, either in, just in life in general?
Mm-hmm. Well, I would advise myself to listen carefully inside yourself, to find out what mm-hmm. your passions are and to follow these passions. Listen to advice from others, but never feel obliged to do anything just because somebody believes it's necessary that you do this or that, because then you will not become happy, I think. So if you follow your own heart, your own passions, maybe considering some advice, but in the end, find your own way. Then you will be successful and happy.
Excellent. I think that's a great closing. I think that, yes, that actually taking the time to know exactly what it is that you like and that you're actually passionate about will make things much easier afterwards, right? Because then you follow your own heart and don't give in to, for instance, social pressure or expectations of your family or of your surrounding, but are really doing what you believe is going to be also easier for you to do. Because if you love it, then
excellent.
It's just
yes,
easier, right?
100%. As long as you like what you're doing, you will be happy and successful automatically. Yeah, and even nowadays, if I realize that my profession is boring or wouldn't give me satisfaction, I would change it. I would right now become a carpenter. You know, this is my plan B. So whenever the day arrives when I'm fed up with being a patent attorney, I will go to the next carpenter and ask him for an apprenticeship. It takes 2 or 3 years. But I think I will do that. So that's my plan B if anything goes wrong.
Excellent. So maybe just to close this, I think for those that are listening today, maybe it's also a good idea to have a plan B.
Yes.
So thanks so much, Peter. I know you're extremely busy. It's a busy time of the year. I hope you're well. Take care. And for those that are listening to us, please don't forget to subscribe to Lead a Ching. Give us a thumbs up.
Well, thank you.
Milka. Bye, Peter.
Good success for your podcast and see you around. Take care. Yeah. Bye-bye.
Thank you. Bye.
I hope you liked this episode of Lead a Ching in English. Don't forget to give us a thumbs up on your respective platform and subscribe to our podcast. See you soon!